Okay, well, I'd like to thank Marty and the other organizers for the invitation to come here, get out of Leipzig for a week and see the sun and the sea and all that. I did just arrive yesterday, so if the talk is incoherent or doesn't seem clear, I'll blame it on jet lag. And I understand from Marty that this has been a fairly informal series of talks, so I'd like to just keep it that way. So please feel free to jump in anytime you have questions or comments. Based on the talks, the schedule that's been up so far, and from the interest from the, what I hear about from the people here today, I think what you're going to hear is much more sort of empirical driven rather than theory driven. So our interest, as the title says, is trying to detect local selection in human populations. And so the idea behind this is that due to a great deal of work by a lot of geneticists and archaeologists and paleontologists, we now have a reasonably coherent picture, I think, of the evolution of modern humans is occurring in Africa, somewhere between 150 and 250,000 years ago, and that modern humans then, beginning around 50 to 100,000 years ago, began spreading out of Africa in a series of more or less reasonably well-characterized migrations. And so the question we have then is that, okay, so modern humans arose in Africa, then what happened? Well, one of the things that we think must have happened is that if modern humans did arise relatively recently, and it's only in the past 50, 60, 70,000 years that they first began migrating perhaps across as well as out of Africa, then it's relatively recently that they're encountering these new environments, new climates, new diseases, new parasites, new sources of nutrition, all sorts of new things that they hadn't been exposed to up until that time. So in principle, there should have been plenty of opportunity for local populations to adapt to these new conditions by, you know, Darwinian natural selection. And therefore, that should alter the patterns of genetic variation at those genes that are responsible for those traits. And of course, dealing with humans, one can also start to think about sexual selection, what possible role sexual selection might have also played in producing some of the differences we see among different populations today. And yet there are actually very few examples where we really can say with a high degree of confidence that yes, we see an altered pattern of genetic variation at this particular gene in these particular populations, and it's for this particular reason. So we like to try to understand more of these cases. You know, coming at this from an anthropological viewpoint, I'm interested in the stories. What were the stories that happened as human populations moved out into these new environments? So as an example, so that everyone is clear about what sorts of things I'm talking about, the classic example of local adaptation is lactose tolerance. So lactose is the main sugar that's present in mammalian milk, and in most mammals, the ability to digest lactose disappears shortly after weaning. So it's a classic example of the evolutionary principle of use it or lose it. Most mammals, you're not exposed to lactose as a dietary source after you're weaned from your mother's milk. Therefore, there's no need to continue producing lactase, to continue to have the ability to digest lactose. However, some of us humans are weird. Some of us humans actually retain the ability to digest milk all the way into adulthood. And if you look at the basis for this trait, it turns out that it correlates quite highly with the frequency of dairying, with the production of milk and the use of milk in the diet. So you see this across different populations where traditionally they've made much more use of dairying as a source of nutrition than populations that have it, the sort of rough correlation with the frequency of lactose tolerance or lactase persistence, as it's also called. Moreover, there's a frequency gradient across Europe. So you have the highest frequency of lactose tolerance in northwestern Europe and the lowest frequencies in southeastern Europe, again, correlating quite nicely with the frequency of dairying across these different regions and the importance of milk in the diet. Moreover, there's also a rough correlation between lactose tolerance and dairying in Africa. So there's some populations in Africa which also make use of milk in the diet. Now, it's important to keep in mind that there are a lot of populations that make use of milk in various capacities in their diet, but this is actually drinking of raw, unprocessed milk. Okay, if you make yogurt out of milk, for example, that destroys the lactose. The genetics of this trait have been well worked out. It segregates in families as an autosomal dominant trait. And there is a mutation that's been found in a regulatory region. This mutation is referred to as CT14KB that in families co-segregates with lactase persistence. And there have been further functional studies of this polymorphism to show that in cell lines it does correlate with the expression level of lactase. And moreover, the frequency of this mutation correlates with the frequency of lactase persistence in European populations and in some, but not all, African populations. So here's the frequency of lactase persistence as a trait, and this is the frequency of this particular mutation in various populations from Europe. You see a very close correspondence. It's not exact because different people were measured for the trait than were measured for the frequency of the mutation. It also accounts reasonably well for the frequency of lactase persistence in some of the African populations, like the Fulbe Hausa. But there are other African populations which have a much higher frequency of lactase persistence than they do of this mutation, which would suggest that there may have been additional mutations that have occurred in these African populations to confer the ability to digest lactose into adulthood. And indeed, last year that was found to be the case, and it's studied by Sarah Tishkoff and others, where they looked at mutations in the lactase and in and around the lactase gene in some of these other African populations and found other mutations that functionally do increase the expression of lactase and that correlate well with the frequency of lactase persistence in these African populations. So it's a very nice example of convergent evolution. So different populations being faced with this different selective pressure, namely drinking milk into adulthood, and using different mutations to solve that problem, basically. Moreover, it turns out that there is a very strong signal of selection on lactase persistence in humans. And I'll go into more detail how one detects these sort of signals of selection and characterizes them. But the reasoning is fairly simple. What you basically expect under neutrality is that the age of an allele is a rough measure of its, the frequency of an allele is a rough measure of its age. So the older an allele is, the higher in frequency it will be, or higher frequency alleles are expected to be old alleles. At the same time, if you have a mutation sitting on a chromosome on a haplotype, then as that allele is increasing in frequency, the length of the haplotype gets shorter due to recombination and new mutations. So under neutrality, old alleles, high-frequency alleles, should have short haplotypes associated with them. Selection drives up the frequency of an allele very rapidly, too rapid for recombination and new mutations to shorten the length of the haplotype. And so one of the signatures of an allele that has been driven to high frequency by selection is that you have a long haplotype associated with it. And that's what this cartoon is meant to illustrate. Each of these horizontal bars indicates the length of a haplotype associated in red, either with the persistence allele, or in blue with a non-persistence allele. The frequency of the persistence allele is something like 80 or 90%. So it's a very high frequency allele. If it were driven to that high frequency by neutrality, we would expect to have short haplotypes associated with it. Instead, we see long haplotypes associated with it. And one can do this in a little more rigorous fashion and do simulations, for example, under neutrality. And then you see, again, this sort of inverse relationship that I mentioned under neutrality. Alleles that are low in frequency have long haplotypes. As the frequency increases, the haplotypes get shorter. And so you can do 10,000 simulations under neutrality using a demographic history that you think is appropriate for European populations, for example. And then this is what you actually observe for lactase persistence. So you see something that you would never produce under neutrality, given the demographic model used here. So that's still, even though this is one of the sort of best known examples of local selection in human populations, we still don't know the whole story. One of the open questions is still, why should there have been such strong selection? I mean, remember, when we say that we see a signal of selection here, what we really mean is that people who carried this allele were either surviving or reproducing more often than people who did not carry this allele. So what was going on? Why was there such strong selection? Well, the sort of traditional explanation would be the nutritional advantage, that if you were able to drink milk into adulthood, that gave you an advantage over people who were not able to drink milk. Now, in today's society, it's kind of hard to imagine that being able to drink milk really confers such a strong selective benefit, that you would really survive and reproduce that much more often than people that don't, to produce this strong signal of selection that we see. But of course, 10,000 years ago or so, maybe that wasn't the case.
Yeah. What do you mean by strong selection? Like 10% more offspring or 1%? Or?
This has been modeled, and it's somewhere around 5 to 6%.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, maybe 10,000 years ago or so when dairying was first invented and humans had to live through long, hard winters and things like that, maybe having this extra source of nutrition was just enough to give them that sort of advantage. But since it is hard to imagine that just drinking milk alone would do that, people have sort of sought other possible explanations. So one that has been proposed is that maybe it's not a source of nutrition, but rather a source of water in arid zones that would replace water. And this may very well account for the signal of selection on lactase persistence in Africa, because in some of those African populations, it seems pretty clear that being able to drink milk is a considerable advantage in the very arid environments that those populations live in. But note that in Europe, the frequency of lactase persistence increases in northwestern Europe. It's lowest in southeastern Europe, so it does not correlate with sort of aridity or with, you know, problems with sourcing, finding water as a source. Another explanation that's been proposed is that maybe it's not the nutritional advantage, but rather providing calcium that may have been important in the diet, and for preventing rickets or osteoporosis. This is particularly important for pregnant women because the developing fetus imposes a very heavy calcium load on the on a pregnant woman, and if she's not getting enough calcium, the developing fetus will actually leach calcium from the skeleton of the woman, and that can result in pretty serious health consequences. And so you can imagine then that might have a strong fertility benefit.
At what age do children or people lose the lactose digestion ability if they don't have the persistence?
If they don't have the persistence allele? I don't know offhand, but I think it's within a year or so. Yeah, fairly rapid, that's my understanding. Another possibility, and this was just, you know, talking with people in my group about this and sort of an idea that came up, and we just throw this out. We haven't thought about this in any great detail and certainly haven't tried to model it, so I have no idea if this would actually work in practice or not. But another potential benefit would be perhaps not in terms of survival, but rather in terms of fertility. That is, if a woman is able to wean their child earlier because of the presence of milk, then perhaps then she's able to regain fertility more earlier on, and therefore during her reproductive lifespan have more births than women who do not have the trait of lactase persistence. So this is something that could be modeled and looked at to see whether that would possibly explain this or not. But again, so we have a reasonably good story, but we still have lots of explanations here to consider. Okay, so how can we go about identifying local selection in human populations if that's what we're interested in? And just as in trying to identify genes for diseases, there's sort of two approaches that we can use. One is the candidate gene approach. So you think of a trait like lactase persistence that you're interested in, and you try to think of all the genes that might influence that trait, and then you go out and study variation in those genes. And if you've been very lucky or very clever in your choice of genes, you might find an interesting story at the end of this. But if you haven't been so lucky or so clever, you might end up doing a lot of work and not have much to show for it. So just as with disease mapping, the approach that most people, and the one that we've mostly adopted, is to use a genome scan approach. The idea is to survey lots and lots of markers across the genome and look for patterns of variation, look for signals that might suggest something unusual that's due to selection that's happened. So what do we need to do this? Well, we need data, and we're very fortunate in the human genome community that there are lots of public databases that can be mined for this sort of information. So some of the ones that you'll hear about include the Seattle SNPs database. This is a bit of a misnomer because it's not actually SNP data. By SNPs, we mean single nucleotide polymorphisms, where you just assay the allelic state at a particular site in the gene or in the genome that you're interested in. But rather, this is full sequence data, and this is out of date. They're continuing to provide data for additional genes and now additional populations. The Purigen Company published a few years ago a database of an analysis of 1.5 million SNPs in samples of African Americans, European Americans, and Han Chinese. Those are publicly available. The HapMap project, of course, is one that most people have heard about. This is the HapMap 2, is 3.8 million SNPs. There's now a HapMap 3 that just came out. Fewer SNPs, but typed in more populations. So that's an ongoing project. Again, all the data publicly available. And the last resource I'll mention is this CEPH-GDP. This is at the Center for the Study of Human Polymorphism in Paris. And HGDP is the Human Genome Diversity Panel. And this panel, which is publicly available, of roughly 1,000 DNA samples from 51 populations from around the world, was recently genotyped at 650,000 SNPs. And that's all publicly available. So there's lots and lots of data that we can explore. And in addition, we and other groups are involved in generating more data that can be used. Okay, so we have lots of data. What do we look for in these data? Well, again, there's sort of, if you think about what positive selection does, local positive selection, the model here is that we have an ancestral population. Perhaps part of that population moves off into this new environment. So we have part of it stay behind. Part of it goes off into this new environment. There's now a new selection that's imposed on this population. So a previously neutral variant or a new mutation occurs that confers an advantage, and that gets pushed by selection to high frequency. So if we compare the patterns of variation around this segment of DNA in this population and this population, there's sort of two signals that we would look for. One is that on average, the genetic distance between the populations is going to be bigger for a selected locus than for a neutral locus. And the second one, as I talked about, is that you get a reversal of the sort of usual, that is what you expect from the neutrality, inverse relationship between the frequency of an allele, which is a proxy measure of its age, and the associated length of the haplotype, also is referred to as LD, or linkage disequilibrium. So to measure this relationship between the length of a haplotype and its frequency, there have been a number of different statistics proposed. The one that I'll focus on here is called, there's lots of abbreviations here, lots of acronyms. So the LRH is a long-range haplotype statistic. The one that we use is called the relative integrated extended haplotype homozygosity, or RIEHH. But again, the concept is pretty simple. You start with an allele at low frequency, it drifts under neutrality to high frequency. By the time it gets to high frequency, the length of the haplotype is short. Positive selection drives that allele to high frequency without shortening the haplotype. And so the way we can measure this is to take a particular SNP, a particular position in the genome. We can simply calculate it, this extended haplotype homozygosity for SNPs further and further away from the SNP of interest. Do that for the other allele at that particular SNP. So most of these positions we look at are biallelic. So we have two alleles that we can compare in this population. We can construct these curves. We can integrate under them to get the area and take the ratio of those two to get our statistic. We do that for one like this, where there has been selection, then we expect a large difference between the extended haplotype homozygosity. And so, and the R just simply means we take the ratio of those two. So we can plot this for all the different SNPs in our database and see which ones look unusual. Now, the way the statistic was originally developed was to compare two alleles within a population. That certainly has a lot of information. It's a very useful approach. What we've done is to extend it in a different, slightly different direction by considering the IEHH values between two populations for the same allele. So this approach, as I said, does lose power, though, when one allele is near fixation. And it's impossible if you have fixed alleles, because then you know you don't have another allele to compare it to. So one way around this is then to compare the decay of the AHH for the same SNP between two populations. And that turns out to give us good power for detecting sweeps that are near or at fixation compared to this approach. So the idea, again, very simply, is we look at each SNP, we calculate this ratio values in two different populations, and then we identify a cutoff level by simulations, and I'll show you an example of that, and look for regions that have lots and lots of SNPs that deviate from neutral expectation. So an example is if we take the HapMap data and just scan along a region, particular region of a chromosome, we calculate all of these IEHH values in black for the Europeans, in blue and just mirrored across here for the Africans in this particular database. And if we pick a region of the genome that looks like this, we can actually see for each SNP what the extended haplotype homozygosity plots look like. Not much difference between Africans, Europeans, or Chinese here. But if we go to a region of the genome like this, we see a huge difference between the Europeans and the Africans. And again, we can plot this for each individually for each SNP. And then we, using a cutoff value, calculate how many of these are above our cutoff value based on simulations. And we see that we have a whole bunch of them piling up in this particular region here. So without knowing anything else about what's going on, we would say here's a region of the genome which looks pretty different between Europeans and Africans and may be suggestive of selection. And I chose this region for a reason, because there is a gene in this region, SCL24A5, which has been previously implicated as involved in skin pigmentation differences between Europeans and Africans, and was previously identified as showing a signature of selection. So use one of the ways of validating this approach is that we do tend to pick up these signals of selection in regions of the genome that have been previously identified as showing signatures of selection for other reasons. Yeah.
In cases where you have a local population that was founded by a small number of individuals, then there's always a chance that they simply carry a particular allele.
Right. I mean,
and just the expansion of that founder population brought it to high frequency.
Right. So what happens is, as an alternative, is that changes in demographic history can also produce these sorts of patterns. And that's one of the questions, one of the problems with this approach that I want to touch on next. And that's that there's nothing, although we can do this and we can go and identify these unusual patterns, and some of them indeed do involve genes that show signatures of selection, there's nothing in this whole approach that says that selection was necessarily responsible for this, right? In fact, you could go to your computer and simulate a whole bunch of genes under neutrality and do exactly the same sort of thing. You can calculate these IHHA statistics, you'll get a distribution of them, you can go out to the tails and say, oh, these are the ones that are unusual in this whole distribution, but there's nothing in that whole process that says selection must be operating. So that's one of the ongoing questions here is, we detect signals of what look like to be outliers. How can we be sure that these are actually due to selection? And there are a number of...
What was the nature of the other evidence you mentioned? Was it also based on similar things? Or?
No, it was based on allele frequency differences, but actually this particular gene was the zebrafish one, so it was found as a skin pigmentation difference first in zebrafish and then shown that actually also held in humans. So how can we be sure that we're detecting signals of selection in genomic data when we use these sort of outlier approaches? Well, our hypothesis is that if there are demographic factors that are instead responsible of the sort that Marty just mentioned, changes in population size, bottlenecks, and so forth, any demographic factor, by definition, is expected to have an equal impact across the genome. I mean, we'll have differences in terms of the variance, of course, as to what you expect. But the overall average effect should be the same across the genome if you have a migration, if you have a change in population size. The difference with selection is selection is only expected to influence particular genes, those that are responsible for influencing the traits under consideration. So to test this idea and to see if there is anything going on in empirical data that cannot be explained simply by demography, the approach we took was to generate simulated data under a wide variety of neutral models, compute our particular statistic here, and then standardize the distributions under different neutral models and compare quartile-quartile QQ plots. The hypothesis being that if no matter how you change demographic history, if you do the standardization and then compare the QQ plots, they should line up with each other because they should have the same average effect. And so,
excuse me.
Yeah.
So what exactly do you mean by equal impact? I mean, different parts of the genome are also under different degrees of maybe negative selection. So,
yeah. So
we may also, in the absence of positive selection, have different impacts on this.
If it changes just the overall, if one can think of an average impact of negative selection, I don't think demography is going to. So what might happen then if you change the environment or something like that is you may change some aspects of negative selection as well. But again, that should only influence particular genes that are involved in whatever's changing the environment, right?
No, but then you would get a sort of a pattern over the genome. Right, but of how strong locally negative.
Negative selection is, right. So that's
so
something.
My question, what do you mean by equal impact?
What I mean by equal impact is that if I change the population size so that the NE changes, the NE changes for every nucleotide, right? If it's a demographic effect, so.
It may be different.
It may be different depending on selection, but then that's sort of what we want to detect. I mean, it may not be positive selection in the extent that we're thinking. Maybe it's relaxation of constraints, or maybe it's a change in the negative selection. But it's going to produce, I mean, the fact that it's something different about that gene means something has changed for that gene, right? And that's sort of what we want to detect.
Actually, this is maybe sort of the first introduction of this whole general problem of what constitutes a reasonable, like, null model to compare, you know,
sure.
against. And of course, you know, people have gained somewhat greater sophistication in trying to incorporate what they think are reasonable demographic models. But there's a kind of this much deeper problem potentially, and maybe it'll come up more next week, especially where people are maybe estimating that there is a lot of selection operating all over the genome,
right?
Both positive and negative, and so. Maybe raises questions about the adequacy
of and just simple demographic models.
Neutral model modified by so this is not criticism of what you're doing, but probably a really hard problem.
No, but it's one that needs to be thought about, right? And dealt with.
Is there utility in coding and non-coding regions in terms of looking at demographic effects, population sweeps versus?
Yeah. I mean, we can, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in detail about what other things one can look at. I'm trying to tease this whole thing apart. So what we did as sort of a crude attempt to try to get at this is we took neutral models and we tried to vary everything we could think of. So we took a simple model where everything stays constant, and then we varied recombination rate, we varied mutation rate. In this model, which is specific for humans, we're looking at Africa is a source population, and then a population moves out of Africa. Is that a single ancestral population for Europeans and Chinese that then splits, or are there independent ancestors for Europeans and Chinese? So we considered that. We looked at changes in population size, bottlenecks, expansions, migration, and we also looked at ascertainment scheme, because these SNPs are not just randomly ascertained from across the genome, but there's a bias in that frequently they're first typed in some subsample of individuals, frequently of European ancestry, and then typed in the whole larger sample of individuals. So that introduces an ascertainment bias, which can potentially influence results. So we looked at all these different things, and then each model we used, we compared each model as well as our empirical data to a full neutral model. And by a full neutral model, I mean we used the parameters that were estimated by Schaffner et al. In 2005 that they considered best fit empirical genomic data from Africans, Europeans, and Chinese. So with all those limitations in mind, nonetheless, what we found is that when we compared any neutral models in these QQ plots, we do see pretty good fits. It's only when you get to the very extreme tails where you have few observations that you start seeing deviations between the two. And then when we take empirical data, no matter how we compare them to any model going on, we always see a bigger deviation than we do in any of the simulations that we did. So our conclusion from this would be either there is some demographic factor that we haven't accounted for in these simulations that is accounting for this, or there is something else going on, namely selection in real data that is producing these tails that deviate in these QQ plots. Or it could be a combination of the two.
Is it varying in mutation rate that's across sites, across
them? Yeah. You never find anything that can fit this, no matter how we vary things.
What are each of these model 1, model 6? The last one is ascertainment?
Yeah, this is an ascertainment scheme. I would have to go back to the paper to see what these are. And this is all published, so. And all the plots are in the supplementary data for all the different models. We just showed a few here. Okay, and one other thing we did was ask, okay, so that's fine. That says there's some signal of what goes on in in the real, in empirical data that we can't account for with the demographic models, at least those that we've considered, do we actually have any power in this approach to detect selection? So if selection is going on, do we even detect it with this approach? And so we used Kevin Thornton's method to simulate this. And under simulations, under various, these are actually strengths of bottlenecks, so this is also looking at effects of bottlenecks on population size. What we find, not surprising, is that if selection is weak, we have very little power to detect it. But once selection gets to be reasonably strong, this method actually has good power to detect it. That is, if you simulate a locus under selection with a bunch of neutral loci and apply this model, when selection is reasonably strong, you do detect the selected locus among what you call the outliers. It corresponds to somewhere between 1 and 10% selection, yeah. Yeah, exactly, that's the whole point. Weak selection so far is the big bugaboo. It's very difficult to detect weak selection.
We found the same general phenomenon in the Arabidopsis SNP data set that you generated.
Yeah.
So there's 1,000 more or less evenly spaced regions across the genome. They're panel 96. And no matter what kind of statistic you look at compared to neutral models, it's always way too much in the test. You try to, tune the demography or standard, adjustments to the neutral model, and then you can never really get rid of the problem. It wasn't clear what kind of model would be appropriate.
Molly.
So you said that there are different bottleneck strengths in these simulations?
Yeah, this is what the 0.1, 0.2, and 0.4 indicate.
The strength of selection is at present?
The strength of selection would be, let's see, how did this work? This was a bottleneck, I forget how long ago in the past the bottleneck was, but then the selection would be ongoing, yeah. Okay, so well, this is one example of methods for taking genomic level data and scanning through it and trying to identify outliers. There have been many, many approaches developed and proposed in the literature for doing this. They all have various strengths and weaknesses, but what they all end up doing is producing sort of a laundry list of candidate genomic regions or candidate genes that have been putatively under selection. And that's where all of these approaches stop, right? They stop with producing this list and saying somewhere then usually in the conclusions that, oh, it would be interesting to investigate these further to verify and understand further the signals of selection. And that's sort of the problem we're facing with now. I think with the methods we have, we have some reasonable methods that we can take any genomic data set and identify outliers that certainly look like they may have been produced by selection. So the question is, what do we do next? And the answer is, I don't know. I think there's a lot of room for some creative people to do more work here. But what I'll do now is show you two examples that we've tried to work through in a little more detail. Certainly have not solved the problem by any means, but at least we've gained a little more insight into what we think is going on. So the first example I'll talk about is a gene called TRPV6. The way we picked up TRPV6 is we went to the Seattle SNPs database. Again, it's full sequence data. The time we went through it, the database consisted of sequences of 221 genes from 24 African Americans, 23 Europeans, one chimp to give you information on the putative ancestral state. As I said, now there's lots more genes and populations in here. And what we did was to simply calculate two different measures of genetic differentiation. So looking at the amount of genetic difference between populations, between the African Americans and the European Americans. One is just the FST, a standard measure of genetic distance between populations. And the other is a statistic we call the ratio, LNRH, which stands for the ratio of the number of haplotypes. So you look at the number of different haplotypes in a gene in the African Americans, divide that by the number of different haplotypes in the European Americans, take the natural log of that and plot that. And so if you just simply plot that for these 221 genes, you get this scatter plot of LNRH. High values of LNRH mean big differences in the number of haplotypes. High FST means big genetic distances between populations. And you see one, a number of putative outliers, but if we just start with the most extreme values here, Those are for a gene called TRPV6. And Seattle SNPs provides some nice resources on their website for visualizing the haplotypes. So this is we call a haplotype visualization plot. So each row corresponds to a haplotype, to a chromosome, basically, from an individual. So there are two chromosomes for each individual. Each column is a SNP. It's a polymorphic site with two alleles. So one is color-coded blue and one is color-coded yellow. And so you just look at this visually and you see in the African Americans, lots and lots of variation, lots of blue and yellow box. You see in the Europeans, hardly any variation. Pretty much all of the Europeans have the blue allele for each of these polymorphic sites. There is one exceptional chromosome among the Europeans. And it's kind of interesting is that if you go look at other genes in the same individual, you also see the same pattern, that this one individual tends to have a number of chromosomes that look more like Africans than like other Europeans. And so probably this individual, we would speculate anyway, has some recent African ancestry. Anyway, it's a dramatic difference there. You can do the usual tests for deviations from neutrality on TRPV6, and you get significant HKA test values. You get significant endogenous D value, again, all suggesting selection on TRPV6 in Europeans. And if we look at this, one of these haplotype, extended haplotype homozygosity graphs, starting from a particular core that consists of three polymorphic sites. These three polymorphic sites all involve non-synonymous mutations, so the mutations that change the amino acid sequence of the protein. We see that what seems to be driving the signal of selection that we detect here are that we have in Africans a haplotype which we would identify as ancestral, meaning that at these three amino acid positions, this haplotype retains the amino acids that you see in the chimp, and this haplotype also shows the fastest breakdown of EHH, which is also what you would expect if it is the oldest haplotype. We see sort of an intermediate haplotype that has a derived state at one of these positions and the ancestral state at two, again, only in Africans. And then we have the completely derived with the derived state at all three positions in the African Americans. That's the breakdown versus the Europeans. So a large difference between the same haplotype in Europeans versus African Americans. And if you go through and do this for all of the genes in the Seattle SNPs database, this is the largest difference that you would see between two haplotypes that are the same in Europeans versus African Americans. Okay, so now you start to ask, okay, so it looks like, yes, maybe there's selection going on. Might there be selection for TRPV6? Well, what does TRPV6 do? TRPV6 is a calcium channel. It's a primary source of calcium channel uptake from the diet. It's expressed in the intestinal tract. As I said, there are three amino acid substitutions between the ancestral and derived haplotypes, with the derived one being at high frequency in Europe. We can use some very crude models and do some very, very rough dating of when these three amino acid substitutions might have been fixed, and the date we get is roughly 11,000 years ago. Other groups have done the same thing using different methods and also gotten dates of 10,000 to 12,000 years ago with big standard errors on them. But you look at this and you say, selection in Europeans, something involved in calcium, 10,000 years ago. Maybe that sounds like dairying. Maybe this is the lactase story again. Well, the easy way to test that is to check other populations than African Americans and Europeans. And so we did that. We typed this in the CEF human diversity panel and a few other populations. And so what we see is that in Africa, there are many, many different haplotypes presented here. But outside of Africa, almost all populations are fixed or nearly so for this blue-derived haplotype. So it's not just in Europe that one sees it. One sees it everywhere. Every single population looked at outside Africa has this haplotype in very high frequency, often being fixed for this haplotype. Just because they have it at high frequency doesn't necessarily mean they show the same signature of selection, though, that you see in the Europeans. So to check that, we sequenced around 4 kb around this gene in four other populations, in Pakistani Chinese, Papua New Guinea, and the Caratiana from Brazil. And these are now the EHH graphs for those. So again, here we have, lowest here is the the African ancestral, and then this intermediate one. Yeah, let me go back here. here's what we see for the Europeans, and then these are the other four populations. So if anything, even more extended haplotype homozygosity in the non-European populations than in the Europeans for the same haplotype. And we can get even more information on this by looking at the HapMap data. So this is the EHH graph for TRPV6 from the HapMap data, which includes, again, an African population, the Yorubans, Europeans, and a Chinese sample. And what we see is this huge difference between the EHH and the Han Chinese and the same haplotype in Europeans or Africans. And the signature seems to extend over nearly a megabase. So that brought up, then raised another question. Would you see this amount of difference in the EHH between the Han Chinese and the Europeans if it was the consequence of the same selective event in an ancestral population of Han Chinese and Europeans? So to address that, I'll skip the details, but we carried out simulations where we asked if there was an ancestral population that had to be at least 40,000 years ago between Europeans and Chinese. Selection happened in that ancestral population. Then the population splits to form Europeans and Chinese. Do you expect to see such a large difference in the EHH? And the answer, going through lots of simulations, varying different parameters and so forth, is that no matter what we did, we could never produce this large difference in the EHH signal between Europeans and Chinese if the selection had happened in an ancestral population. So therefore, what that implies is that what has actually happened is that there's been parallel selection on this haplotype in at least these two different populations, in the Europeans and Chinese. So to summarize what we know at this stage about TRPV6, we get strong evidence for selection in all non-African populations. We very roughly date the selection to around 10, 12,000 years ago, but these things inevitably come with very wide standard errors. Why? Well, at that point, we thought maybe some functional data might help. Maybe that might tell us a little bit more about what's going on. So what we did then was to enlist the help of some colleagues at Leipzig University, who in turn got us in contact with some other people who are experts on these calcium channels in Belgium. And what they did was to take the ancestral and derived haplotypes. So we have these three amino acid differences between them. Take those DNA sequences, clone them into expression vectors, and then take a human cell line and transfect them. So add these vectors into these cells, get these genes expressed in them. So now they're pumping out these calcium channels onto their cell surfaces. And then what they did was to do patch clamp analysis. So they take a single cell, clamp it, and then they put electrodes into it and run various solutions through it and look at the change in the electrophysiology of the cell. And that tells them about whether there are any differences in the function of the calcium channel in these cells. So we have cells that are overexpressing wild type, sort of ancestral form, and cells that are overexpressing the derived form, and see if we pick out any functional differences. And so they ran through their all sorts of tests that they normally do on these sorts of channels, and I certainly can't explain all of these, what they all mean, but the bottom line is that none of them showed any significant statistical differences. However, I will draw your attention to this one here. This one comes closest to achieving a significant p-value. And it's also perhaps the most interesting biological difference between these two, because this relates to the shutdown of the channel in the presence of excess calcium. So you want your channel open when you've got calcium coming in, but at some point you want to shut it off if you have too much calcium coming in, or that can also have negative consequences. And the derived form tends to shut off much faster in the presence of excess calcium than does the ancestral form. But nonetheless, we don't see any significant differences in how they're functioning as a calcium channel, so now there's all sorts of other possibilities one could consider. Maybe it's instead protein binding differences. So this is the structure of the TRPV6 protein here. This is the cell membrane here. Part of it sticks out, again, because it's a channel. Part of it sticks in. These are where the three amino acid substitutions are. And two of them are in these calmodulin binding domains. So these are domains of the protein that bind to other proteins called calmodulin, are involved in other intracellular signaling. So maybe it's something like that, or maybe it's expression differences. Maybe we're just being fooled by these amino acid substitutions, and it's actually levels of the channel that differ. So we're going to look at that. But at the moment, what we can say is we see the signature positive selection in all non-African populations. We feel it must have occurred in parallel in Europeans and Chinese, possibly other populations as well, depending on how strongly you want to believe this date of 11,000 years. Humans were in the New World before then, for example. They were in New Guinea before then, for example. So it may have been even more instances of parallel selection. We do not, though, have any significant differences we can point to in terms of functionality between the ancestral and derived alleles. So either there's some as yet undetermined functional difference, or possibly levels of expression differ, or possibly this is nature not being very kind to us and it's all really neutrality and not selection at all. But like I said, at least we've learned a bit more about this. Yeah.
Did you say, will we know where these this gene is expressed in what type of cells?
Yeah, we know it's intestinal tract.
There's another issue. Why are those polymorphisms present there? Not such low frequency in the African population.
Yeah, we've looked at that. We looked at that a little bit, and there's some suggestive, but not conclusive by any means, evidence to suggest that maybe selection is ongoing in Africa too, but that it either started later or is weaker.
This is actually a very interesting question.
Yeah.
About, you know, the origination of these adaptive alleles, because somehow they already got to some modest frequency
in Africa.
And maybe they both weren't adaptive, but became conditionally adaptive when they moved.
Yeah, I mean, this is a...
So it's a question of, you know, that's right. In situations like that, potentially, where you have these polymorphisms that are conditionally adaptive, well, let's say you're right, and there is selection. It happened to be on a derived allele, and you get this nice pattern, but could just as well, you know, maybe these conditionally adapted ones could have been on an ancestral, in which case you get very strong selection, and you maybe wouldn't pick it up by half of that cancer.
Yeah, it may be a different type,
so, this question about the origination of these adaptive alleles and haplotypes
I think it is, and there's been some work done on a sort of standing variation. Like Molly's done some work on that. It shows it's something you really have to take into consideration. Okay, so that's where the TRPV6 story, such as it is, stands. I should say there is very recently some additional information, though, from the literature to suggest that there may be difference in susceptibility to gallstones between people with the derived and ancestral forms of this gene, and if so, that would sort of tie into this idea that it's the shutdown of the channel in response to excess calcium that might be important here. So that might be a direction we need to think more about.
Usually we do take a short, 10-minute break.
Okay.
It's 11 o'clock now. It doesn't have to be right now, maybe in 20 minutes, but it's up to you. You know how much more.
Oh, it's up to you. I mean, this will take maybe 15 minutes or so to go through, and that's it.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Maybe you want to
still
stick 10 minutes. Or you think, you just have enough 10 minutes to just go through. Yeah, okay.
Okay. So the second example of a gene that we've talked about, we're looking for what the story might be, where I think we've had a little bit more success, involves a gene called EDAR. So EDAR is a gene that has popped up in pretty much any scan that's been done for signatures of selection in the human genome. No matter what sort of test you use, it always seems to pop up, and a number of different people have commented on it. And it shows a signature positive selection, specifically in East Asians and Chinese. And again, you see that if you look at these haplotype visualization diagrams comparing the Seattle SNP data for African Americans, Europeans, somewhat less haplotype diversity, but Chinese, you essentially just have a single haplotype there. Very little variation around the Chinese. And again, a very unusual pattern to see. So what is EDAR? EDAR stands for the ectodysplasin A receptor. So it's a cell surface receptor. It's involved in skin development, epidermis development. It's expressed during fetal development in skin and kidney and in lung tissue, and it's also expressed in craniofacial tissue. So why focus on EDAR? Well, it turns out there are mutations that reduce or eliminate the function of EDAR in humans, and they all produce a characteristic syndrome called hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia. And the syndrome involves defects in hair, in teeth, and in sweat glands. Now that starts to get a little interesting, because there are characteristic differences between East Asians and other populations in hair morphology, tooth morphology, and sweat glands. So now you wonder if maybe this gene might not be involved in some of those. Another reason for focusing on EDAR is there's a convenient tool to try to get at some of the possible functional consequences here, because there is a non-synonymous, again, amino acid-causing substitution which has an extremely high FST value in the HapMap data set. So this substitution changes a valine, which is ancestral, to an alanine, which is derived. And this alanine form is completely absent in the Africans and Europeans in the HapMap data, and it's just about fixed in the Chinese. So the FST value would also be 0.96, and that is, I believe, the highest FST value for a non-synonymous SNP in the HapMap data. And it's not just restricted to the HapMap data, but we've typed this in the CEPH-GDP panel. So there's a lot of information on this slide. These are the populations in the CEPH-GDP. The little numbers that you probably can't see here are the sample sizes. The bars here reflect the allele frequency of the derived allele. So you see the derived allele is absent from Africa, basically absent from Europe, starts to appear a little bit in Central Asia, but is widespread across East Asia, reaching fixation or near fixation in most of the populations. It's also high frequency in the Americas, low frequency in Oceania. And this is just using a simple random resampling test to test the significance of FST values between each of the 51 pairs of populations. So the darker the block, the higher the significance of the FST value. And this is doing it on a regional basis, so lumping these populations into African, Middle East, Europe, et cetera. And basically what you see is that the East Asians are significantly different from everyone else. So it's not just a HapMap, but it holds elsewhere. This is a schematic of the amino acid sequence of EDAR. So again, it's a cell surface receptor, so part of it sits outside the cell, part of it goes through the cell membrane, part of it is inside the cell. The amino acid position we are interested in is this one here, and it occurs in a part of the protein which is known as the death domain. And the reason it's known as the death domain is because there are maybe half a dozen or so cell surface receptors which have similar domains like this. When they get activated, when they bind to their ligand, that introduces a conformational change in the protein down here, and it induces cell death, apoptosis. EDAR, however, does something different. It does not induce cell death, even though this is called the death domain of the protein. The domain is interesting because it's very highly conserved, so you have the same amino acid sequence across the 70-some-odd amino acids. Humans, chimps, dog, mouse, rat, and chicken only differs by two amino acids. So it's very highly conserved, suggesting it's a very important function that it carries out. This is the one here, the one blocked down in red here. Moreover, there are many of the disease, known disease-associated mutations in humans also occur in this region. So these other ones are all mutations which either reduce or eliminate the function of EDAR and produce this disease syndrome. And again, here's the one that we're interested in. So how does EDAR actually work? What does it do? So here is EDAR sitting in the surface of the cell with the cytoplasm here. It binds to its ligand, equidisplacin A. When that happens, it introduces a conformational change on the inside, and it causes it to bind to a protein called EDAR-RAD, which is the EDAR death domain-associated protein. And that initiates a whole cascade of signaling that ends up in activating a protein called NF-kappa-B. So NF-kappa-B normally is sitting in the cytoplasm, inactivated, not doing anything. When it gets activated, then it moves into the nucleus, and it's a transcription factor. So that means that it then binds at various locations on chromosomes throughout the genome and induces transcription, induces the making of messenger RNA and then of the protein of those genes. So that then raises, and that whole cascade then depends critically on this interaction between the death domain of EDAR and the EDAR-RAD protein. So that raises the question, does the amount of NF-kappa-B activation differ between the ancestral and derived forms of EDAR? And so what we did to test this was to use an in vitro transfection assay. This is one that's been previously developed for one of these disease-associated mutations, and which showed that there was, with this disease-associated mutation, highly reduced NF-kappa-B activation. The approach that one does then is, again, you clone the ancestral and the derived forms into expression vectors. And we did this both on sort of the normal background, but we also included a disease mutation as a control to make sure that the assay was working properly. And then in the transfection assay, you have your cells, which have their endogenous EDAR, but then we add this EDAR vector under a strong promoter, so it overexpresses either the ancestral or derived form of EDAR in those cells. At the same time, we transfect another plasmid, which contains a promoter for NF-kappa-B, some of these NF-kappa-B recognition sites, linked to luciferase. So luciferase is a protein that was originally isolated from lightning bugs, and when it gets activated, it produces light. So the idea is that we get overexpression of the EDAR intracellularly, that then stimulates EDAR-RAD, which then stimulates NF-kappa-B activation. Some of that moves into the nucleus of the cell. Some of that, though, will attach to the promoter on our luciferase plasmid. And measure the amount of the strength of the activation of NF-kappa-B then can be measured by the amount of light that is emitted in this assay. So it sounds simple. It took a little while longer than that to get it up and running, but we finally were able to get reproducible results. And when we did, what we found was that, first of all, that on the background of the disease alleles, that the NF-kappa-B activation was essentially knocked down, but that there's also a significant difference between the derived and the ancestral forms. So higher NF-kappa-B activation with a derived form of EDAR than with the ancestral EDAR. So we were pretty happy with those results until about a week after we got them. A Japanese group published a study on EDAR where they did the same thing, and they found exactly the opposite results. So they found higher activation of EDAR for the ancestral form rather than for the derived form. But there was another group that's been working on this. This is a competitive area. So there's a group in Manchester, Dennis Hedon's group, that had also done this. And their results confirm our results. That is, they got the same thing we did. So two out of three groups agree that it's the derived form that produces a higher activation. And if one looks at our conditions versus the conditions that Dennis Hedon's group used versus the Japanese group, the Japanese group transfected a lot more protein, and they let their cells grow for a lot longer period of time than we did. So technically, that means that there's maybe cell death going on there. But we don't know for sure why they got this different results. Could also be that their plasmids got switched around. Okay, but this is all. So far, we do have some agreement anyway that the derived form results in increased activation of NF-kappa-B. Now, what might be the phenotypic consequences of having this increased activation of NF-kappa-B? Well, what the Japanese group also, first of all, what the group of Manchester showed, what has shown, the reason they got interested in doing this is they study genes that influence hair morphology in mice. And one of the genes they've been studying is EDAR. And one of the things they did was to take mice and engineer them to overexpress the mouse endogenous EDAR. So these are not humanized mice. They don't have any of the human forms of the genes, of the EDAR gene, but rather they're making lots and lots of mouse EDAR, more than mice would normally make. And the phenotypic effect that they get out of this overexpression of mouse EDAR is they get hairy mice, mice with much thicker coats. And they looked at all different aspects of this hair morphology, and they see that it's, again, much thicker hair in these EDAR mutant mice than in the wild-type mice.
Mark, just a quick question. Did you all use the same cell lines, each of the three sites?
We used, our group and the Manchester group used the same cell lines, and the Asian group, I think, used two different cell lines, and this is the same one we used. Okay, so overexpressing EDAR results in mice with thicker hair, and the Japanese group has also shown that there's an association between hair thickness in individuals from Indonesia and Thailand and genotype at the EDAR locus, with thicker hair being observed with individuals with a derived allele. Now, in principle, this sort of association could be reflect one of two things. It could reflect either a real association that this allele is having a direct effect on hair thickness, or it could be a spurious association because there's some sort of population structure going on here, and it's just showing an artificial association with hair type. The way you control for that is to type additional SNPs. The control of the Japanese group was to type one more SNP and show that that one SNP was not associated here. So that's not generally considered to be an adequate control for this sort of work. Nonetheless, I think they're probably correct that there is an association here because the Japanese group has just recently published another study where they, on a different set of populations, where they also found the same sort of association between EDAR genotype and hair thickness, and where they did include quite a few more SNPs to control for population structure. And we have collected samples from Colombia earlier this year and measured hair. We're measuring hair thickness now, but we look at hair morphology, and we see an association between hair morphology, that is, straight hair, wavy hair, or curly hair, with the EDAR genotype. So there does seem to be a role of this gene here on hair morphology in humans. So to conclude, we see that EDAR experienced strong positive selection. Again, we can use these crude dating methods, and we come up with a very rough estimate of around 20,000 years ago for this selection. Results from 2 out of 3 groups suggest that the derived allele has a higher activation of NF-kappa-B, and that this derived allele may have an effect on hair thickness and morphology. However, the possible reason for selection remains unknown, and at this point I can think of 3 possible reasons why there might have been selection on EDAR. First of these would be that there was selection directly for thicker hair, for this hair morphology in East Asians. Now, it's kind of hard to think of why Darwinian selection would operate on people with thicker hair in East Asia. But some people have proposed that perhaps it was reflected or related to some sort of adaptation to cold or something like that. On the surface of it, it doesn't seem so likely that there would have been such strong selection to produce, again, the signal that we see of strong selection on the gene itself. So another possibility would be natural selection for some other effect of 370A, and to my mind, that seems to be the most likely explanation now, because what this derived allele does is it changes the activation of a transcription factor, which then goes and has who knows what effect on all sorts of other downstream genes. And it turns out that NF-kappa-B is particularly important in immunity, in the immune response. And many of the genes that are activated by NF-kappa-B are involved in the immune response to infectious diseases. And so that seems like, to me anyway, a pretty reasonable or likely target would be that NF-kappa-B activation changes the immune response to some infectious disease. Yeah, Molly?
In the association of EDAR to hair thickness or hair morphology, how much of the variance does it explain?
That's a good question. I think the Japanese were finding it explained somewhere around 20-30%. But the third possibility, if it's not simple Darwinian natural selection that's sort of interesting to entertain, to speculate on, is the possibility of sexual selection, that people with thicker hair were seen as being more desirable, more attractive as mates in East Asia, and that resulted in driving this allele to high frequency. I'm not quite sure how one might go about testing that hypothesis. I mean, suppose one could do one of these tests where you show photographs of people to college undergraduates and ask who they find attractive as a mate, and then see if that shows an association with EDAR or something like that.
And you also select 4 mice with thicker hair and see whether this allele is increasing in frequency.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things one could do, is take more advantage of this mouse model and see what else might be going on there, particularly with respect to the second idea about selection for something else, if one. That would be one thing to do, although that's not a trivial undertaking to do. But that would be also an obvious thing to do, would be to humanize mice and see what effect that has. And then one could then, you know, with mice, then one can run them through all sorts of tests. There's a clinic in Munich, a mouse house in Munich, that does these sorts of tests on mice, that runs them through all sorts of different parameters to see what might be changed in them.
Northern China is much colder than the southern China.
Yeah.
So the first reason you mentioned, you know, the selection because of the temperature, does it somehow, because there's such a wide temperature difference in China.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think the convincing enough to temperature is a driving force in this.
I would find it hard to believe that temperature alone would be such a strong driving force. But that could be tested, right? And that's one of the reasons why we went to South America to get samples, because you do see ER at high frequency also in South America, but presumably for the past 10 to 15,000 years, they have no longer been, if cold is the driving force, they have not been exposed to cold for that period of time, or for the past 10 or 15,000 years. So therefore, one would predict one might see a relaxation of selection on that. So that's something we want to look for. The HapMap data is, I think, mostly Northern Chinese, and as well as the Ceph panel. It's mostly Northern Chinese. You do see the allele at fairly high frequency in some Southern, Southeast Asian populations, for example, but my take on that would be that was brought in recently by the Austronesian expansion into those areas. So that doesn't necessarily tell you anything about selection going on in those areas. Yeah.
I mean, you spent your whole career, you had interest in understanding human evolution. But if you're actually interested in the more general question of understanding the role of selection and patterning and variation, or the recent studies like that, would you be doing it in humans?
Oh, no. No, but as an anthropologist, you know, if you're interested in humans to start with, and then you want to know what are the different things that influenced human population variation. But no, of course, no, I think mice would be an obvious choice, or fruit flies or something like that, where you've got short generation times and can carry out experiments and that sort of thing. I mean, the only reason for doing this sort of work on humans is because we find humans interesting, right? I mean, you would never choose it as an experimental organism.
First example, you mentioned that maybe the food can be a different, makes a difference. Is that right?
With TRPV6, it's a calcium channel, so presumably it could very well interact with the diet, with what are the important sources of calcium, how much that has varied, what effect agriculture had on calcium uptake, whether there's an interaction between calcium and certain infectious diseases is also a possibility. So there's all sorts of ways one could try to go there to try to investigate this further. The simplest one that we want to do, we still haven't done, but we want to do is to look at expression level differences and just make sure that it's not something like that that's going on. Yeah?
You only went through a few examples, and at least in two of them, very like the most extreme examples
right.
You can find in the human genome. You're sort of skimming these examples.
Mm-hmm.
How many are there, do you think, that have patterns that would warrant...
That would warrant investigation?
Well, and I have no sense of it. Are there,
yeah, yeah.
Is it 10 or 20 in the genome, or are there...
Well, if you do these sorts of different screens of the genome, and it all depends on how you set your cutoff values for what you think is significant, but most people come up with somewhere around between 100 and 300 regions of the genome that look like reasonable candidates for selection. How many of those are just false positives and how many of those are real selection? I don't know. And how much that's been weakly selected that you're not picking up in these tests? I also don't know. I think, you know, given what we can do at the moment with both with our tests and with trying to chase down the tests, it's certainly most reasonable to start with the strongest candidates and go from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what about the cross section among methods? What number? I don't have a sense either. How many would that lead to, for example?
Oh, if you take the cross section of all the methods?
Look at the cross section.
Yeah, yeah.
Are we talking about 10 or 20? Or?
I would guess still in the order of maybe 50 to 100. But I mean, something else that maybe you have a better idea of than I do is just how independent are these methods anyway? I mean, if you look at something that has high FST, that's probably going to bias what you expect in terms of EHH anyway. So they're not exactly independent ways of picking these things up. But yeah, that's typically what you would get, I think, in a cross-section.
Yeah. Are there any examples?
Oh, I'm sure there will be, but.
So how far are we into statistical power methods to start?
I don't know. I don't know if anyone has tried to look at that question to see what, if you have a, you know, just even a simple two-gene model influencing a trait, what you would expect to see in some of these tests and whether or not you would be able to pick it up with our existing methods or not. I don't know offhand that that question has been looked at.
I have the same idea, you know, when you're talking, you're starting with these extreme candidates, but then the genes have a function, and you're also thinking about pathways, so start with
pathways, connected pathways,
sure.
Yeah, I think that way we probably have some powers to look at ontologies and things like that, and look for, and people have done a little bit of work along those lines, but not any really formal modeling with, say, a two-gene model and see what you can expect to find.
How many of these regions
does
that also pop up in all these genetic epidemiological studies that are becoming more and more popular and producing longer lists
of candidate genes for different complex diseases? Sometimes they come up, but I don't know if they come up any more than you would expect just by chance.
Are there a number of brain genes on the list, and some of the earlier publications about some candidate brain genes?
Yeah, microcephalon and things like that, yeah.
Are they still on the list?
Generally not, no. Further work on that hasn't really panned out to show that both of the signature selection is necessarily that strong when looked at in a genomic context, as well as looking at functional consequences. So even though mutations that knock out these genes result in reduced brain size, there's no evidence, at least that I know of, and it has been looked at fairly intensively to show any relationship between any cognitive abilities in these mutations.
Other brain genes that are showing up?
I'm sure there are, but they're certainly not among the top candidates.
Picking your brain. Chris was telling us about this, the 1,000 human genome project.
Yeah.
So obviously, whatever medical reasons are, perhaps you would think that with like these very high density SNP chips. So I'm just wondering, you know, are you gonna be able to extract a lot more having complete genome sequence as opposed to having 3.6 million SNPs or something like that, or some high number? And if you had resources to choose how you would want to spend it, would you try to get more information from different populations or different groups? How
would
you, from your perspective,
mix? Well, I mean, our own approach in the
selection.
Yeah, in the in terms of the laboratory work that we do in generating new data, is to focus on populations that are not in HapMap, not likely to be in HapMap, at least not in the near future. And yet, what we think they're interesting phenotypes are other reasons to suspect that their selection may have played a role. So, for example, Polynesians. Looking at possible selective targets in Polynesians, who there's this long-standing hypothesis in anthropology that the so-called thrifty gene hypothesis that Polynesians were subject to very strong selection for very efficient metabolism during their long open ocean voyages and periods of feast and famine on the islands once they got there. And so those are the sorts of things that we're doing.
Get more standardized population sampling?
There was, and it died. It was a human genome diversity project that never really got anywhere. The Ceph panel that everyone uses nowadays is the best that could be done. There's a genographics project where they're collecting samples for their own end, and also running into the same sorts of problems that the HGDP project ran into. So no, there is no standard, at least I'm aware of, standardized.
Alan Wilson, he originally wanted to just put a grid across the line.
That's right,
Stand on the grid. But these kind of discussions of
how to rationally sample more populations really isn't.
Not as a, I mean, it's what, you know, people like me and Chris and, you know, there's several other groups that are still in the process of collecting samples and generating data to address questions of particular interest. But certainly no coordinated project. And, you know, given the political climate in a number of these areas, it would be very difficult, I think, to mount a real sort of global effort to do this.
So given population expansions throughout the world, throughout the history, it seems like most of these SNP analysis is going to give you information about changes within the past 10, 20, 30,000 years. Is there an attempt to try to build up that sample of chimpanzee and other non-human primate databases to make more comparisons with humans, getting deeper changes earlier on?
Yeah, there are. There's certainly a lot of work being done on sort of chimp genomics, and there's also the Neanderthal Genome Project going on at our institute to see what insights that might provide. Well, starting with as complete a Neanderthal genome, whole genome as one can get, and then doing analyses based on that. Yeah. So, yeah, these methods for looking that I've talked about, the EHH methods and that, you could probably only go back 10, 20,000 years, expect to really see a signal, maybe a little more than that, but not much more than that. So it is all looking at sort of recent history. And then there are other methods one can use to look at genes that were selected between, say, humans and chimps. Those can be applied with once one has the Neanderthal genome to look at things on that sort of time scale. But
have results already started to come out? From the still preliminary building up the genomes at this point?
It's, I think we're pretty close to having the a finished sequence.
Is it possible to do a bit more to roll in and roll out the expansion of a small population with regard to explaining these specific cases? I was struck by the fact that the alanine mutation didn't seem to be present in Oceania among the Asian populations there. Does that contradict the migration maps?
No, not at all. It's just because it's sort of a weakness in the human genome panel that it only includes two populations from Oceania, and they're both from New Guinea, one from Bougainville and one from New Guinea. So we've done more genotyping in that area of the world, and what we see is that in Polynesia, it's at a higher frequency again. So it's consistent with the predominantly but not exclusively Asian origin of Polynesians. And that mutation was brought into that area probably by the Austronesian expansion. So the indigenous New Guinea groups that were the result of an earlier migration didn't carry that mutation. Okay, so I'll finish with the most important slide, the acknowledgments of people in my group that did the work on the various projects I talked about. Yarik is actually in Svante's group, but we sometimes poach people for particular projects. So Kun Tong was a former postdoc who's now at our partner institute in Shanghai, who did a lot of the theoretical work on developing these EHH-based tests for comparing between populations. David Hughes has done the work on 56. Sean Miles is a former grad student now at Cornell, who did the work on EDAR in conjunction with Yarik, and of course a number of colleagues, and especially when I single out all the people who contribute to these public databases that make this work so much easier, and the Max Planck Society for making it all possible. Thanks.